Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. We're taking a look at your pet's health today on the show, to begin the show anyway. We're talking about all the potential hazards the holidays present for your beloved dogs or cats or maybe other pets as well. And here to talk with us and give us some advice, Dr. Sam Bilko, a UW School of Veterinary Medicine faculty member and small animal emergency veterinarian at UW Veterinary Care. And as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. You can join the conversation. Maybe you've got a question or a comment. The number 1-800-642-1234. It's 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Bilko, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on, Larry. I'm really excited to be here to talk about holiday hazards for our pets.
Yeah, before we get started, it's just interesting to me that you're an emergency pet care vet. That's primarily what you work on. You get into some scary situations, I would imagine. How do you initially assess an animal when it comes in?
Yeah, that's a great question. I work primarily in emergency and critical care, so we take care of the sickest patients in an animal ICU, just like humans have an ICU after the ER. So it can be scary both on the front end when they come through the ER and then get hospitalized in our intensive care unit. You know, we assess pets the same way that you would assess a person. We look at, you know, how they're thinking, their neurologic status. We look at how they're breathing, how their heart sounds and their lung sounds. And then we kind of narrow down the organ system that we think is affecting them most. And we target our testing and treatments to what we feel is going on with them that day. And then decide from there if we think they're sick enough that they need to stay with us in the hospital, or if they get to go home with some medications.
So what kinds of questions, I'm thinking about the person who brings in the pet, what kinds of questions would you be asking that person so those of us who have pets will know or have some good information to tell you when you ask?
Well, the biggest thing is, you know, what brings you to the emergency room today? You know, things might be going on with your pet for a little while. Some of our pets have pre-existing conditions or other illnesses or issues that have come up in the past. But what is the problem today? And then really focusing on that. Is it vomiting? If so, we want to know all the gross things, what's in it, how many times, how big those piles were. The same with diarrhea, as gross as that sounds. We like to hear that information. You know, if you think they have belly pain, where is it that hurts when you touch? If you think they're coughing, what does it sound like? What is their environment at home? Do they take any meds? All of those types of questions and answers are really helpful for us.
Probably wouldn't hurt if the cat throws up or the dog throws up, for example. Probably wouldn't hurt to take a photo of that.
I love photos.
At home.
Yeah, I love photographic evidence.
It's great now with the phones we've got that it's quick and easy to do. So here we are. The holidays are with us. Pets are tempted to eat new foods, maybe decorations, Christmas trees. What are the most dangerous things you see dogs and cats eat that bring them to this?
I would say every year, by far and away, chocolate is going to be the number one. But around the holidays, we start to see other issues as well. So animals getting into really kind of high fatty foods or really spiced foods can get a more non-specific GI upset. They can get something called pancreatitis, which is where one of their digestive organs starts secreting those digestive enzymes not into the gut where they belong. And that can create a really painful condition that also causes vomiting and diarrhea. So we find those, you know, ingredients in almost everything we make for the holidays, really.
Yeah. I was remembering a time when I interviewed someone who, and we were right near the end of the interview, and she looked quite distressed at the end of the interview, and it was, the show was over afterwards, and she got up and said, "I got to get home." She had left out she had some gum.
Oh, yeah.
She'd left out forgot that she'd left it out, and she was racing to get home to get it before the dog. I can't remember. Was it a dog or a cat?
Absolutely. So sugar-free products contain xylitol, and gum was the primary offender for a while, but now we're starting to see sugar-free peanut butters and puddings and toothpastes and even those little melatonin gummies you might take before bed all contain xylitol. So it's really important to look for that ingredient. If you're going to bring it into the house, make sure the dog doesn't get into it. That can create a condition where their blood sugar drops really low if they get into a lower amount of it, all the way to liver failure if they get into a really large amount of it. And it can be hard to deal with after they've eaten it because it's absorbed very quickly, usually within 30 minutes of ingestion. So I'm glad she ran home. I hope she got it away.
Yes, she did. The dog hadn't found it yet. Would it affect cats the same way?
Primarily dogs.
Yeah. It's primarily dogs. So what holiday food is safe to eat for the pets?
Usually I say as you're preparing your Thanksgiving dinner or Christmas dinner, you want to take some of the more pure ingredients after you cook them and set them aside. So before you start adding all of the spices and seasonings and gravies on top, so a little bit of plain cooked turkey, a little bit of plain cooked sweet potato, green beans, those types of things are okay for the dog. As a general rule, you know, treats and toppers should never make up more than 10% of their daily caloric intake. So we want to make sure that we're giving them small amounts of all of these things. And the bulk of their meal is just their regular food.
So that piece of fat from the turkey skin or something is not something you want to be giving your...
I try to stay away from the, you know, visible pieces of fat and the pieces of skin. Some dogs just have more sensitive stomachs than others do, and you never know if you're going to get into a situation where they do have GI upset because of that.
So, and here's another thing about, go back to chocolate for a minute. So you left a piece of chocolate out, and your Rottweiler eats it, one piece. Is that going to make you want to take the Roddy to the vet?
So many questions. Was it a piece of pure baker's chocolate, or was it a piece of milk chocolate? Is it in the wrapper? Is it plain? All of these things kind of play into the effect that chocolate can have. As the chocolate gets more and more concentrated, so do the toxins. And so things like dark chocolate, bittersweet chocolate, baker's chocolate contain a lot more of the toxin than a milk chocolate bar, for example. Plus, the packaging can create its own problem in the form of obstruction of the GI tract. So while, you know, a small square of Hershey's milk chocolate in a Rottweiler-sized dog is probably not going to create an issue, a small square of baker's chocolate might contain much more of the toxin.
I have a relative who usually brings a loaf of, I forget what they're called. They contain grapes, and they might have raisins in them and other fruits. So what about, let's say, grapes, raisins, maybe onions?
Yeah, a lot of toxins you just named there.
Could be in, well, those weren't all in his presentation, but that reminds me of onions and maybe garlic.
Absolutely. Yeah, so grapes and raisins, currants, those types of things that can be found in fruitcakes are toxic to dogs. They can cause kidney failure. The active ingredient we've just discovered is actually something called tartaric acid. So we definitely want to stay away from grapes and raisins. There's some theory about how many it takes to really cause illness in a certain size dog, but we don't have all of the data there yet. So right now we say, you know, stay away from it completely and let your vet know if you feel your dog has ingested one of those things. As far as onions and garlic go, those are going to be found in almost all of the savory holiday dishes as additive spices. Both of those things can cause GI upset. They can cause red blood cell issues as well in larger amounts, which is why we want to make sure that none of the sauces or dressings that contain those ingredients then go to the dog's food.
What about cranberries? We are definitely in the cranberry time of the year.
Yes, absolutely. Cranberries themselves are not toxic. The sugars and things that we add to it can cause tummy upset in your dog. But they're not toxic in the way that grapes and raisins are.
Okay. And I'm thinking a couple more come to mind. Something like walnuts. We see a lot of walnuts. We see, of course, mushrooms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Nuts in general have much higher fat content. High fat foods have been linked to that pancreatitis that I mentioned in dogs, which is that inflammation of the digestive organ that causes vomiting, diarrhea, and belly pain. Walnuts that you find falling outside from the tree can actually grow mold on them as well. That can cause its own set of problems. Other nuts, you know, like unsalted peanuts, for example, could be a good snack for your dog. Macadamia nuts, on the other hand, contain a neurotoxin. And so as a rule, when I give nuts to my dog, I actually do kind of unsalted plain peanut butter for them as opposed to the whole nut to avoid that higher fat content.
But not the diet peanut butter.
Not xylitol, sugar-free peanut butter. Absolutely, you're correct.
Okay, once in a while, and it's not often, but once in a while, I'll bake some bread. I like to do that. The problem I have with it is that when it comes out of the oven, I want to eat the whole loaf. But how bad is it for pets to eat bread and unbaked, and more, maybe more important, that unbaked bread dough as it's rising?
Yeah, that's a great question. We're all getting our bake on for the holidays, making something fancy. So unbaked doughs are the major issue, and that's because the yeast has not risen yet, and it likes a warm, moist environment to rise that dough. And so when the dog ingests unrisen bread dough, the yeast then activates inside of them because they are a nice, warm environment in their stomach. As it activates, two things happen. One, the dough ball gets really, really big in size, and it actually obstructs the stomach, so nothing can pass through the stomach. But unlike other things that you can actually induce vomiting and get the toxin out of the dog, it also, because it's this big ball of dough, can't come out the esophagus either. So we have to do some special procedures sometimes to actually remove the dough.
Cut into the animal?
We try to do something called a gastric lavage, which is where we put them under anesthesia and we pass a tube that goes through the mouth and into the stomach. And you can use cold water to try to deactivate that yeast, bring down the size of the dough ball, and flush the pieces out so that you don't have to cut into the animal. That would be the best and hopefully most effective way to get it out.
Dr. Sam Bilko, our guest today, UW School of Veterinary Medicine faculty member and small animal emergency and critical care veterinarian at UW Veterinary Care. Great to have her with us. Questions for her about your pet's health? I hope you join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking today with Dr. Sam Bilko, a UW School of Veterinary Medicine faculty member and small animal emergency and critical care veterinarian at the UW Veterinary Care. It's great to have her with us. And we'll be talking at 12:30. We're switching gears entirely and choo-chooing on to talk about electric toy trains with Roger Karp, who has a really cool new book out on the Lionel trains. And it's a photo history of an American icon, and it'll be fun talking with him. But right now, we're looking at your pet, and I hope you'll join in. Oh, Bill and emailed to say, this is a sad tale, I'm pretty sure. Their dog grabbed an entire stick of butter off the dining room table and gulped it down before she could be stopped.
Oh, no.
The dog had runny stool for a couple of days, but Bill didn't take her to the vet. Should he have taken her to the vet?
So butter is one of those high-fat foods we were talking about, especially a whole stick at a time. a lot of how your dog is going to react depends on the size of the dog and how strong of a stomach they have, but that's certainly one of those foods that can trigger pancreatitis, which causes vomiting, diarrhea, belly pain, and can really range from self-limiting diarrhea all the way to several days in the hospital with more intensive care. So as a general rule, I would say if your dog gets into that much butter, it's probably worth a trip to the veterinarian just to get them checked out, see if we can induce vomiting to bring any of that up before it's absorbed into the GI tract.
That would save a couple of rainy days.
Yeah, and potentially a larger hospital stay.
Oh, well, Charles in Oshkosh has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Charles.
Hey, Larry. On the subject of raisins, we came home Christmas Eve a few years ago to discover our standard poodle had consumed a small package of yogurt raisins. And this might be something to discuss. I found out in the course of this that there's a pet poison control number that you can call. And they put you on the line with a vet, and we got great advice on induced vomiting with hydrogen peroxide. But then we, you know, you don't know how long ago the dog ate the raisins and all of that, and how many came out. And we took the vet to an emergency veterinary clinic up here in the valley. But what was interesting was the vet told us that raisins and dogs are one of the science. He said that some dogs can eat just a few raisins and get really sick, and another dog will eat a whole bucket of raisins and be fine. And our dog stayed overnight and was fine. I was wondering if the guests could dig in a little deeper on the raisin mystery.
Charles, thanks for calling. Dr. Bilko?
Yeah, Charles, that's a really great story and brings up several good points there. One, there are certainly pet poison hotlines that you can call. So one is the Pet Poison Helpline. The other is the ASPCA Poison Control Center. And we always recommend calling one of those two facilities first to speak to a toxicologist or a veterinarian about what your pet has ingested and if there is anything that you could or should do at home before making the trip to the ER. Because as we know, no one wants to spend their holiday waiting in the emergency room. So sometimes it's not enough that you even need to go to the vet and you're able to manage it at home with some supportive care. Sometimes it warrants more concern and we definitely need to make that trip to the ER. So it was great that you started with calling that number. As far as the number of raisins that it takes to make a dog sick, your vet is very right that it depends on the size of the dog. And again, until recently, we really didn't know what the toxic principle in a raisin or a grape was. We now know it's something called tartaric acid that has recently been confirmed. However, we still don't know the dose amount. We used to think it was what we call idiosyncratic, meaning it's a random toxicity that happens in one individual in, you know, 1,000 that's out there. We don't really know who it's going to be. So we always recommended inducing vomiting and going to the vet for supportive care afterwards. Now we're starting to collect a little bit of data about how many raisins does it actually take. The jury's out on what that exact number is, but there is definitely going to be some kind of dosage information available in the near future.
Probably the size of the dog might have a...
Yeah, usually the size of the dog is a very impactful factor. Again, we just don't know how much of the toxin exists in certain types of grapes, you know, green grapes versus purple grapes. Or is it more concentrated in raisins? That's the information that we lack currently. By inducing vomiting in your dog as well, they probably evacuated a lot of the toxin itself in a process called decontamination, and that saves them from being affected by the toxin the next day. So I'm really glad that your dog got to make it home.
Yeah, absolutely. And Joel Padnod provided me with the number, the phone numbers, the 800 numbers for the ASPCA Poison Control Center. It's 888-426-4435, 888-426-4435. Or the Pet Poison Helpline is 855-764-7661. Got that right?
Yes, that's right.
855-764-7661. We'll post that up, but I think if you type in poison, pets poison control or something like that, or poison control center for pets, it's going to pop up.
Yeah, they pop up very readily. It's really useful to the veterinarian as well, because they'll give you a case number that you can then bring to the emergency veterinarian, who can also reach out for special advice, individualized advice for your pet based on the amount that was ingested, to help really create the most appropriate care plan for them.
Bill in Barnes, Wisconsin has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Bill.
Good morning, Larry. I've been waiting for months for the guest that might answer this question. We've had three golden retrievers, the English cream, and they all love birch bark. If there's a stick or a rotted out log where the birch bark is a seed, they will shred that. And I don't really encourage it or let them do it, but if I let them, I think they'd eat the whole thing. I'm just wondering, is it, somebody has speculated that they like the salicylic acid aspirin that's given them some relief, but is there any toxicity issue? Is it beneficial? And why do they crave it?
Thanks for the question, Bill. You broke up a little bit there in the middle. So they're eating birch bark straight from the tree. Is that correct?
Yeah.
No.
Oh,
yeah,
no?
It's been on the, like it has a dead birch tree, or a tree has fallen over and there's a chunk of it laying there. You know how birch rots out, the wood rots out, and the bark is left there as sort of a hollow tree?
Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah, so dogs certainly like to eat some very random things, seemingly. Bark in general and wood pieces outside, my biggest concern for those is more about the possibility to create an obstruction in the GI tract. A dog does not digest the fibers in the birch or in plant material in general, because they don't have the stomach that, like a cow does, for example, to do so. And so it kind of wads up and sits in their stomach and may not pass through normally. That can create a situation where they start vomiting and they may need some kind of procedure or even surgery to remove the bark. So in general, I try to avoid letting them eat large amounts of plant product to avoid that from happening. Salicylic acid, I believe was your other point, is potentially toxic to dogs as well. There are dosing recommendations that some people will sometimes use. However, we don't recommend routine use of salicylic acid in dogs unless under a veterinarian's prescription. So I would, from that standpoint, you know, not let them get into too much medication product.
I was wondering about the birch. Now, he's talking about birch trees, that the birch has fallen down. It's laying there in the ground. So it's going to get mold on it. Would that be another concern for a birch bark like that?
Yeah, some molds can cause tremors of the muscles and almost seizure-like activity. And so there's no saying what mold is growing on, you know, what product out there. So compost piles, for example, trash, even moldy foods that you can find, you know, in the trash can in your house can potentially cause those types of tremors or seizures. So another good point and reason to stay away from things that might be laying on the ground for too long.
Bill, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Ian in Madison, we'll go to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Howdy. Yeah, it's great to be with you. So my question is a little quaint. I have two cats at home already, and now I'm a first-time dog owner with a sweet little puppy named Lois. My question for the expert is this. Assuming that you are a pet owner, what sort of treats do you personally like to give your pets this time of year?
So first off, Ian, thank you for the question. I love Lois's name. That is very cute. This time of year, I usually stick to just the regular treats, actually, that I'm using all year round, to be honest with you. Around the holidays, when I'm having my meal, I will save a little bit of, you know, plain white breast turkey or chicken, maybe a little bit of sweet potato for them as well, and put it over my dog's food. That way they can enjoy the meal as well. Other things you could do, get some low-sodium chicken broth from the store, or maybe, you know, tuna juice for your cats. And you can soak their kibbles in it, give it a little bit of flavor, a little bit of festivity without any of the added, you know, gravy, seasoning, spices, that type of thing.
And I'm just thinking about my cats. One cat likes greenies and would live on greenies if I gave him the chance. And the other likes churro.
Yeah, those are great treats. Greenies creates a whole line of dental treats that will help freshen your pet's breath and keep plaque from building up on their teeth. Churro is also a big hit with my cat. That's a more soft or liquid type treat if your cat prefers liquid to the crunchies. You know, milk bones always for dogs. There's so many dog treats out there. I think the big thing we want to make sure is that we're not giving them any, again, sugar-free products that we might have on our shelves, like peanut butter. Sugar-free peanut butter is a big one. Or potentially a pure grain-free product, if that's the only thing that they're eating, has potentially been linked to heart disease. And so we want to make sure that we are giving them some products with a little bit of grain in it.
And they make greenies for dogs, don't they?
They sure do, yeah.
I remember when I started, I'd been at the vet, and the vet said, well, tiger's teeth are, you know, you should be brushing tiger's teeth, which I felt like saying, well, why don't you give that a try? Because I'd tried that, and the result was not good for me.
Yeah.
Anyway, the next time, and then I started him, he said, well, you could try greenies and see what happens. And the next time I took Tiger in, which is about a year later, he says, my gosh, your teeth are clean.
That's awesome. Yeah. And for Lois, who is a puppy, I also have a newer puppy, and we've been using just plain Cheerios as well, a little bit of low-calorie snack that you can give very frequently. Just, again, the plain Cheerios that you would get for yourself, potentially.
There you go, Ian. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. Kent in Reedstown emailed to ask if squash is bad for dogs.
Squash should be okay for dogs. The seeds and the innards, again, things that can wad up and maybe cause an impaction in the stomach or the intestines, we probably want to stay away from that. But a little piece of, you know, depends on the squash you're talking about, a little butternut squash, a little bit of cooked pumpkin, things like that can be healthy treats.
Raw? Can you do them raw?
I generally cook them first just to soften them up a little bit for easier digestion.
That makes a lot of sense to me. What about, I think I mentioned earlier, my cats love to chew on the Christmas tree, and then they throw up little pieces of needles.
Yeah, what a great point. Cats can be so devious. So the pine needles themselves, if you have a pine tree, can be irritating to the cat's mouth. The GI tract cause a little bit of hypersalivation or oral irritation. The biggest thing we worry about is those sharp pokey ends actually poking out of the stomach or the intestine and causing a perforation or a hole in the GI tract. And that can be a big emergency. So if you like live trees, something like a fir or a spruce that has maybe softer needles that aren't going to be quite as pokey might be a good choice. Or you could try a fig tree this year.
Oh, I wouldn't try a fig tree. Nancy in Two Rivers, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Hello. I am wondering about giving dogs rawhide bones as treats. Yeah, are they good or bad?
Rawhide bones for treats.
Rawhides are another kind of hard treat that can help scrape plaque off of your dog's teeth and certainly keep them busy for a long time. The only issue that I see in the emergency room with rawhides is when they get very small, when the dog is near the end, and they can potentially choke on that. So it doesn't go all the way into the stomach. It kind of just stops in the esophagus. And then we have to go in and get it with a more invasive procedure. And so I usually will take that rawhide away from my dog when it starts to get into that swallowable size piece and be very mindful of if you have both a big dog and a little dog, that the big dog isn't eating the little dog's rawhide because that might already be a swallow size or choking hazard piece.
Nancy, thank you. Let's go to Martin in Friendship, Wisconsin. Hi, Martin.
Hello. I have a 10-pound Shih Tzu, and she's 8. For the last 3 years, she has turned into a mushroom fiend. She lives in an apartment, but she gets outside 3 or 4 times a day, and there are quite a bit of lawn and mushrooms, and that is all she's interested in when she's outside. She just wants to eat those little mushrooms.
Hmm.
And my question is, you know, she's been doing it now 3 years, pretty steady. Should I be concerned?
So it really depends on the type of mushroom that the pet is ingesting. And it's hard for me to say, I'm not a mycologist by any means, exactly what type they are by looking at them. There are certainly very toxic mushrooms in existence. So, for example, Amanita mushrooms can cause liver failure that can potentially be fatal. There are other mushrooms that can cause things like tremors, hypersalivation, changes to the eyes. And so if your dog has been eating these mushrooms for 3 years and hasn't experienced these things, then we may be very lucky in that they are not some of the toxic kinds of mushroom. For me, I try to steer my dogs away from eating mushrooms just because I can't tell by looking at it which one it is going to be, and the consequences could potentially be really serious. So I would definitely be really cautious in letting her do that.
Martin, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. And on to Jerry in Madison. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. I've been concerned about... I'm a retired physician, and I've been concerned about reading about activated glycated end products in human food and its effect on blood vessels, especially in people with diabetes. But now I've heard that the veterinarians have been ahead of the game and have been recommending that you avoid dog foods that have this high heat treatment. Because that produces these AGEs, or activated glycated end products. I wonder what the doctor would think about that.
Yeah, thanks for calling.
That's a really good question. The thing about dogs and cats with these advanced glycolated end products, as compared to people, is that they don't really live long enough for us to see the problems associated with this in chronic hyperglycemia, the same way that we do in humans. So because their lifespan is so shortened, I guess naturally, it's just shortened compared to ours, we don't worry about the effects quite as much as, say, a human physician would.
Okay, there you go, Jerry. Thank you very much for calling. Jeff and Eau Claire emailed to say their dog Piper, an English pointer, prefers eating raw spinach to even pointing out upland birds. Are there any issues for dogs with spinach?
A great question. And like plant material in general, spinach just can be a little bit hard on the digestion for a dog. And so you may see that if they are eating lots of spinach, a little bit of vomiting or GI upset. Spinach does tend to not cause as much of an obstructive issue as something like bark that we were talking about before, because it's a little bit more malleable. But dogs that eat their greens, you know, that's okay, just like for us. Just watch for that GI upset.
Okay. And how much is too much? You know, like a few leaves is one thing, but...
I wouldn't let them eat the whole bag. I think a few leaves is okay.
Okay. Deborah in Trempealeau County emailed to ask about the latest technology for repairing of emergency bloat. Is having bloat kits at home a good idea? Emergency service is a long distance away for Deborah, and they have St. Bernards, which are prone to bloat.
Yeah, that's a great point. So bloat, for those of our listeners that don't know, is a condition in larger, deep-chested dogs where the stomach can actually twist on itself, which cuts off the way out for gas and fluid. It can't leave into the intestines, and it can't be burped out. And so the stomach just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and eventually it can cut off blood supply to the rest of the body or interfere with the ability to breathe. And so it's really important that the gas be released from the stomach and the stomach ultimately be untwisted. Now, in a remote area, what I would say is identify the closest urgent care or emergency veterinarian that can perform the, at least what we call the trocarization or the gas release procedure. And then even if they don't have the capacity to do the surgery, you then have bought yourself time to travel to the nearest facility to do surgery. Unfortunately, there's no way to untwist the stomach at home. So we do need to follow up any kind of procedure with emergency surgery. And therefore, we recommend getting to a veterinarian as soon as possible.
So in Deborah's case, maybe there's somebody closer, a vet closer by, and she could ask that vet, hey, if...
Yeah, just to do the gas release procedure. And then Deborah could take her dog to the next facility that has the surgical care and the overnight hospitalization to do the more definitive cure for the condition.
Yeah, so it'd be good for Deborah to make a call to the more local vet.
Yeah.
And just say, hey, can you do that?
Definitely.
I don't need it now, but I may.
Definitely.
Our guest today, Dr. Sam Bilko, UW School of Veterinary Medicine faculty member, and small animal emergency and critical care veterinarian at UW Veterinary Care. Questions for her, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, and we're talking about, we've been zeroing in on sort of holiday-related foods and such, but there's plenty of other health-related questions you could ask about, too. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. 1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and we're taking a look at your pet's health with our guest, Dr. Sam Bilko from the UW Veterinary Care Facility on the campus of the UW-Madison campus. Great to have her with us. And again, join in. The number is 800-642-1234. You can email to talk@WPR.org. Kevin in La Crescent, Minnesota, will turn to you now. Hi, Kevin.
Hey, good morning.
We lost him, but he has a question relating to antifreeze and pets. That's a really, could be a real problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Antifreeze is, the active ingredient is ethylene glycol, and that is extremely toxic to both dogs and cats. It can cause a range of signs, starting with GI upsets, kidney failure, and then coma and even death. And so we really need to make sure that if we think our pet has gotten into anything containing ethylene glycol, little known fact, snow globes contain ethylene glycol. That's how they create that little microenvironment. So even if your snow globe breaks open and your dog is licking that water, your cat's licking that water, we want to make sure to get them to a veterinarian very quickly because there is an antidote out there. It just needs to get into them within a few hours.
Ooh, okay. And so snow globes, anything else? Antifreeze, snow globes?
If you look at anything that's made for keeping things liquid, so like air conditioning, coolant type stuff, look at the ingredient list. And if you see ethylene glycol on that, that is the ingredient that we are most concerned about.
And it doesn't take much?
It does not take much, no.
Okay. Sharon in Madison, we turn to you now. Hi, Sharon.
I have Irish wolfhounds who have been seen at UW, and I just wanted to mention the UW Vet School does a surgery called, I believe, gastropexy on large dogs. All of my wolfhounds have had it, in which they tack the stomach to the abdominal wall so that it can't twist. So they could still develop bloat, as I understand it, but they would not also develop torsion with it, which is the really dangerous part. And if you look on the Irish Wolfhound websites, the National Club of Irish Wolfhounds, there are acupuncture pressure points that you can use if the dog has bloat that will make the dog expel the gas, and then you can skip a trip to the vet. I also want to say thank you so much to the emergency care vets at the vet school because they just saved my Irish Wolfhound who had pneumonia. So that's all. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much for calling. Well, Dr. Bilko, are you familiar with maybe that instance?
Yeah, Sharon, I think I actually remember your wolfhound that was there with pneumonia very recently. I was in the intensive care unit when they were hospitalized. But in regards to your point about gastropexy, absolutely. So that is a very important preventative procedure for any large breed, deep-chested dogs, just like Irish wolfhounds, poodles, you know, Great Danes, things like that, that are prone to that stomach twisting. We usually recommend if they're females, you can do the stomach tacking procedure at the time of their spay, and therefore you can do two surgeries at one time, get that taken care of. But it prevents, as you said, that stomach from twisting later on. It can still fill with gas potentially, and very rarely can it twist on itself as well. But for the most part, you are correct that they won't need any kind of emergency procedure afterwards. Sometimes we do a little bit of decompression, but we then don't need to follow it up with surgery. Regarding acupuncture, there's a lot of interesting research coming out with acupuncture in general for a lot of different conditions. Certainly, there are homeostatic points that can help the GI tract. I can't speak specifically to the efficacy with bloat in all cases, but if that has been working for you and your veterinarian, I think that's very cool.
Yeah, thank you very much, Sharon. Appreciate your call. Perry in Oconto, we'll turn to you now. Hi, Perry.
Hey, happy Thanksgiving, everybody, and thanks, Dr. Sam. My question is this. It has to do with a condition called mean seeds, and they're awns that have a sharp end to them, almost like a fish hook that dogs that run in fields and stuff can get. It might be in their paw, it might be in their nostrils or in their mouth, but it can keeps working their way into the dog. And have you come across any of that situation? And I don't know if it's also a bacteria in those seeds, like they have in the nocardia situation or not.
Yeah, what a great point. So I haven't heard it called mean seeds before, so that's one to add to my list, but they certainly go by other names, grass awns, foxtails, but they are, as you described, they're little seeds from grasses that have sharp pointy ends that can get into a dog via one of many routes. We often see it in hunting dogs, especially during the hunting season where they have their nose to the ground all the time. They inhale one of these awns down into their respiratory tree and they migrate. They kind of poke their way around through all of the tissues in the chest and they can set up really bad pneumonias. But I have also seen awns get into a dog through the skin as well. Even though they have thick skin, these grass particles are very, very sharp and they can lodge themselves and cause little pockets of infection in the muscles, in the abdomen, behind the eye. It really depends where they get into the dog. And as you said, they do come with bacteria on board just because everything that's outside has bacteria. Nocardia is one of the species that has been associated with plant material in the past, although there are several bacterial species we worry about. And so we do make sure that when we find one of these abscesses or pockets of infection, that not only do we drain it and remove the awn, but we put them on antibiotics that specifically target those bacteria.
Perry, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Ken calling in, is it from Missouri? Or Ken, where are you calling from?
It's Ken, and I'm calling from Monona, Wisconsin.
Oh, Monona. Okay, well, closer by. What's on your mind today?
There seems to be some debate on rattlesnake bites, like you were recently talking about dogs and hunting dogs and people take their dogs out to South Dakota, North Dakota, and I'm just wondering what their recommendations are. Some vets say that the dog will be fine and you don't need the anti-venom, and some vets say you need the anti-venom, and sometimes it's hard to find the anti-venom.
Yeah.
So that's my question.
Yeah, thanks for calling, Ken.
Yeah, Ken, that's really interesting. And a lot of that depends on the area that you're in. So whenever I am going to a new state and when I talk to first responders about emergencies and things to look for, I usually recommend starting by going on the Department of Natural Resources website for the state and look up what venomous snakes are in the area. If there are truly rattlesnakes around, the concern is the bite. We don't know if it's going to be a dry bite, meaning no venom was injected, or if it's going to have venom associated with those fangs. And so the benefit to taking your dog to the vet and getting that anti-venom generally outweighs the risk. A lot of the venom components, the purpose is to digest their prey really outside of the snake's body before they eat it, right? And so that's what it really does to the dog as well. It starts to digest those tissues and it causes bleeding issues and breakdown of the skin and the muscle that can be really traumatic and very difficult to fix once it's happened. So I generally tell people that because you can't tell if it's a wet or dry bite, to get them to a vet as soon as possible. And by the time you get there, there are early markers that we can look for in blood work to see if they have truly been exposed to the venom. Calling ahead to whatever urgent care or emergency clinic, or even your primary care veterinarian if they routinely carry anti-venom, is also a good idea, because then you can find out if they have it in stock while you're on the way and make sure that you're directing yourself and your pet to the right facility.
So you can't have your own handy anti-venom kit?
Wouldn't that be nice? Yeah, like an EpiPen or something. Actually, anti-venom takes a very long time to absorb when it's injected into the muscle, but the effects of the venom become apparent within, you know, minutes to hours. And so because it can take up to 12 hours for an intramuscular injection to become effective, we've kind of already surpassed the time when we're going to see the worst of the worst from a snake bite. You can never reverse the damage from a snake bite with anti-venom. You can just prevent it from getting worse. And that's why it's really important to take care of it as soon as possible.
Yeah. Ken, thank you very much for calling. And Nick in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Nick.
Hey, Larry. Happy Thanksgiving.
To you as well.
My dog has been fighting an ear infection. I've seen this in my other dog that's passed away. He woke up this morning, and of course, he busted some blood vessels in that ear. So now it feels like a balloon. And I'm going to call the vet here pretty soon, but I was wondering what's your suggestion, or what are they going to suggest to relieve that bubble in his ear flap?
Hmm.
Thanks for bringing that up, Nick. That is a very common condition, an ear infection leading to shaking of the head, which then kind of loosens those cartilages in the ear and causes an aural hematoma, or as you said, a ruptured blood vessel in the ear that makes it blow up like a balloon. I think it's a great idea to call your vet, because it can be really irritating to have that condition. Without treatment, the dog might continue to shake its head or scratch at the ear, and then it makes it even worse. So we usually drain the blood out of the ear. That's probably what your vet will recommend. Sometimes there is a surgery if the dog is a repeat offender that can be done to kind of hold those cartilages more firmly together. But for now, I agree with your plan to see your veterinarian, get that ear infection taken care of, and get that hematoma drained.
Nick, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Lee emailed to say their cat's dry food contains cellulose powder. What is its function?
What a great question. So cellulose powder is more like a binding agent that is what I believe. Again, I'm not a nutritionist. I'm an emergency veterinarian. But my understanding is that it functions to bind some of those ingredients together rather than being a primary carbohydrate or protein or fat source. If you look at it, it's probably not one of the first, you know, 3 to 5 ingredients. Those 3 to 5 are usually what makes up the bulk of the diet.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Our guest today, Dr. Sam Bilko, UW School of Veterinary Medicine faculty member, small animal emergency and critical care veterinarian at UW Veterinary Care. Great to have her with us, and she'll be with us for another half hour to talk about your pet's health, and I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234. You can email to talk at WPR.org. We are going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on WPR News, and then we'll be back. I am Larry Mueller. Great to have you with us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at your pet's health. Question about your pet's health? I hope you'll join in. Give a call. The number, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@WPR.org. It's 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Jim in Hortonville, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind?
Hi, this is Jim in Hortonville. So this kind of tags along with an earlier call about the seedons, the grassons, but it's a different plant. And then probably cause different issues. But so in my dealings with wild parsnip, it's caused me some issues in the past, coming in contact with the sap being phytotoxic. I'm just wondering if your guest has had any experience with any of her pet plants having any issues with anything like that, causing any burns to them in their soft tissue, like in the mouth, gums, whatever.
Yeah.
That's very interesting, Jim. I can't say that I personally have had clients that come in with pets that have been exposed to the sap and are experiencing irritation, but dogs and cats can have a lot of the same reactions to mucosal or a topical exposure that a person can. So certainly the sap can be irritating, and if that gets in their mouth, I would expect to see things like pawing at the mouth, maybe a little bit of hypersalivation. Their hair coat tends to protect them from skin exposure a little bit more than we are protected from that. And there is something that I came across as well called poison parsnip, which is in a different family, I think, than the wild parsnip that you're discussing. But when ingested, that one can cause more severe signs of GI upset.
Mm. Jim, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. You know, as we were listening to the news, I was thinking to winter snow. We've got snow coming to the good part of Wisconsin, most of Wisconsin, I think, in the next day or two. And that may mean that we're going to have road salt out there. And I'm wondering about that with you got your dog out for walks, and what's danger does there exist with something like road salt or the salt you put on your sidewalk?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Absolutely. So the paw pads of the dog are really thick, and they're built specifically to withstand the elements and withstand things that they might encounter on the ground. But during the cold weather, when those paw pads tend to crack or become irritated, salt can get in there and become very irritating. Not only that, but the dog will then try to lick the salt off of its paws, and that can cause ingestion problems. So there's usually a lot of electrolytes, not just salt in there, sometimes potassium, chloride, those types of things as well, that can not only cause GI upset, but at really high ingestion levels, neurologic signs, or even heart issues. We're talking more like the dog gets into the bucket of salt, then I licked a little bit of salt off my paws. But you definitely want to watch out for how much cumulatively they're getting off. And you can do things like put little booties on them, use paw wax products, which are a little bit more superficial coatings that you can use on the paw pad if your dog doesn't like to tolerate the whole boot. You can use a pet safe salts for the sidewalk, or even sand, which, although it won't melt the ice, will provide you a little bit of traction without putting that salt out.
Heather in Madison, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Heather. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I have two rat terriers. One is a year and a half older than the other one. The younger one is just going through her first heat. And in the older one has gotten severely aggressive. She is biting her. She's mounting her. She's biting us. I have called the vet, and they are prescribing a probiotic just to make sure she's got gut health and the mind-body-gut connection is good. And they've also prescribed something called Adapto, which is a spray. It's a pheromone spray. I'm wondering if there's anything else I can do to allay this aggression.
Hmm.
All right, Heather. So that's really interesting. It sounds like the one dog might be experiencing a little bit more dominant behavior over the other as her body, the younger one, is going through some changes. Certainly, pheromone sprays and calming collars will work for some dogs, but they don't work for everybody. And so there are environmental modifications we can make, like keeping the dogs separate until the younger dog's heat cycle is over, and then kind of reintroducing them after that's complete. Or there are other pharmacologic agents, talking to your vet about anti-anxiety medications, more short-acting as opposed to long-term, because again, hopefully this is just during the heat cycle. If it becomes a repeated issue during your dog's heat cycle every time, then we have to ask ourselves, is she intended for breeding or not? And if not, then maybe spaying her is a good option.
Yeah, that makes some sense. Heather, thank you very much for calling. Dave in Bluegrass, Iowa. Your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Larry. Great show. I've got a 11-year-old Siberian Husky, and he had one eye that was drooping. The pupil wouldn't react to light. His third eyelid was exposed more than normal. And I took him to the vet, and he's got what's called Horner syndrome. You ever heard of that?
Yeah, Dave, absolutely. Horner syndrome is an issue that happens with the neurologic pathway that starts in the brain and then travels a very long way. Surprisingly, the nerve goes all the way down to the chest and then it circles back up to the eye. So usually when an animal has Horner syndrome, it can represent an issue in one of three places, either in the brain, in the chest, or in the eye itself. There are certain tests that we can do to figure that out. And the best person to possibly see for that is an ophthalmologist. The UW has a really great group of ophthalmologists who are always willing to provide consultation and see emergency patients when problems arise.
Is it something that is there anything you can really do for it?
You can treat the underlying issue and that can resolve it. Sometimes Horner syndrome is what we call idiopathic, meaning it's random and it just happens and it can go away as well.
Hmm. Dave, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Carl in Hayward. Hi, Carl.
Hi. I have a question. It's a question that I was raised on a farm. I'm 80 years old. My mother and my grandmother always used to say, Carl, it's going to rain. I said, how do you know that our dogs are starting to eat grass? Is that a fallacy or is that true?
So is it true that dogs will eat grass before it rains?
Well, Carl, that's really funny that you bring that up. I was just talking to my partner recently about how our dogs and cats and every animal we've ever had is always eating grass, acting like a goat or a cow. I have heard a lot of tales about why dogs eat grass. They're nauseated. They're trying to make themselves vomit. Maybe the weather's changing. And to be honest, sometimes I think they just like it. So the key there is to make sure that they're not eating tons and tons of grass, because like many other plant materials, it's not easily digested. And I have seen obstructions caused by grass. But again, if they're grazing a little bit, that seems to be a pretty normal behavior for a dog in my experience.
But if it only happens when it's going to rain, could have something to do maybe with the barometric pressure?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the dog's mind is a mystery, right? So if only they could tell us what they're thinking.
I know fish bite better just ahead of a rain, and partly that may be due to the barometric pressure. So maybe it works in some dogs as well.
Maybe.
Carl, there you go. Thank you so much. John in Stoughton, we go to you. Hi, John.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
My dog has real sensitive skin. He gets skin infections quite a lot. I've been trying Benadryl. Is there anything I can do to alleviate the situation?
What's your breed of dog, by the way?
Golden Retriever.
Okay.
So allergies are really, really common in dogs. They can manifest as skin issues, the toes, the inguinal area, or even GI upset sometimes. Benadryl is a very common first place to start, but there are certainly other allergy medications that your veterinarian can prescribe to your dog. Sometimes the allergies can even be controlled with specific diets rather than long-term medication. So I would recommend making an appointment to see your primary care practitioner and checking out some of those medications or diet options. There are even injections nowadays that can last for 6 to 8 weeks for seasonal allergies. So it's basically like an allergy shot, and they could be done for the season. So many options, definitely worth a discussion with your family vet.
John, good luck, and thank you very much for calling. And we have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. Speaking of emails, Johnny emailed to say they have giant schnauzers, and for the past year, Johnny has been using Pro Denta dental powder additives for their morning feeding. And Johnny has been noticeably cleaner teeth and healthier gums after several weeks of use. So Pro Denta dental power additives.
Interesting. I can't speak to that particular brand in specific. However, there's a lot of things out there to help prevent plaque and tartar buildup. The key is making sure that we do have the dog's teeth evaluated by the family vet at their annual checkup, because we want to make sure that we are getting at those bacterial pockets and debris that collects below the gum line. And that is what causes dental disease over time in dogs and cats, just like us.
I'm wondering, you know, this time of the year, especially around Christmas time, holiday season, you're going to get, well, and Thanksgiving, you're going to get a lot of people coming to visit your home, perhaps. I'm wondering what that does to the cats and the dogs. Creates a little anxiety, I'm expecting.
Yeah, it certainly does. So that's a really great point. All of us have family over for the holidays, and sometimes those family members come with pets of their own. So it's important to evaluate how your pet does around new people and potentially new animals. You know, doors are going to be open more. People might be feeding your dog scraps under the table or potentially leaving the trash more accessible. So we want to make sure that the pet has a quiet area all to themselves that they can escape to if they need that reprieve, or we can also put them in if we are finding that they might be getting into things. Cats in particular can be very good at hiding, and they can hide illnesses that come with stress. In male cats in particular, we can see urinary tract issues. They can have trouble going to the bathroom, and that can even become a life-threatening emergency when they can't urinate. So really important to pay attention to our pets as we get more visitors.
I was thinking back to actually not the holiday season, but it was a summer holiday season when I had a bunch of people over, and I'm sitting on the porch with friends, and this cat comes up to the front steps. And I said, yeah, that cat looks just like Tiger. And then I looked at it again. That is Tiger. And Tiger was walking up his nose to the front door. And what had happened was one of the young children had let him out the back door.
Oh, goodness.
And he walked around to the front and stood waiting to get back in.
Yeah.
So definitely that door opening and closing. When you mentioned that, I thought immediately of that.
Yeah, absolutely. And making sure our collars and tags are on our pets, our microchip information is up to date. That way, in case there are any unintended escapees, they can be returned home as soon as possible.
Elliot in Whitewater, we'll go to you. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello. Yes, I have a question as far as we have three dogs, two Bassets, and a pug. The pug is about just over a year old. He's not been neutered or anything. He tries to be extremely dominant over the two Bassets that are about nine years old. Except for neutering, is there something to do?
Neutering's probably a good idea. Well, I'm not the vet. Go ahead.
No, I would agree with you, Larry. I think if he's not going to be a breeding pug, his body has now matured at a year old. All of his joints and ligaments should be healthy, and there shouldn't be any issue with neutering him to help mitigate some of this behavior. Alternatively, I think you're looking at behavior-modifying medications, which can be long-term if the behavior is going to be long-term. And so sometimes neutering them is just the easier route to go. Pheromone sprays that we've talked about earlier, you could also attempt. But again, sometimes dominance behavior is a little bit different than stress. And so we're not going to fix it with the pheromones and the behavior modifiers as we could stress.
Elliot, there you go. Thank you. Margaret in Madison, your turn. Hi, Margaret.
Hi. My dog was just diagnosed with a mast cell tumor on the tip of her ear, and the veterinarian treated it with the chemical treatment because she wasn't She wasn't comfortable with doing surgery on the ear. Should I be getting a second opinion? The breeders and the people in the group that I got the dog from are all saying she should have surgery, but they're not the vets. So I'm just curious.
Yeah.
Margaret, can I ask what breed your dog is?
Yes, she's an Irish Terrier.
Okay. So
pretty rare.
Yeah, very cute, though. Mast cell tumors can vary in grade of how aggressive they are. So often the dermal ones tend to be lower grade. However, there are certain breeds, more like boxers, pitties, those types of dogs that can have mast cell tumors, even low grade, that spread very quickly. They can also spread to the internal organs as well. So like the GI tract, the liver, the spleen. I think it's probably a good idea to have that area removed for a biopsy. That way we can define what grade it is. Is it a low-grade one that we don't need to worry about, or is it one of those random higher-grade ones that we do need to explore further and make sure it hasn't spread? So probably a good idea to discuss removal. If your veterinarian is not comfortable with that procedure, certainly referral to a secondary facility. For example, UW has a really great surgery team and a surgical oncology team even that can help with procedures like that and provide you that information and follow-up. So if there is the chance that more therapy is needed, we can get your girl that as soon as possible.
All right. Margaret, thank you very much. Another Margaret, this one from Apple Valley, Minnesota. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, Larry. Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving.
To you as well.
I am calling about my German short hair pointer who is 6 years old, and he has just started pooping in the house. And it's almost like a horse when he poops. He goes while he's walking. Have you ever heard of this? I never have.
Margaret, does it seem like your dog knows what he's doing, or is it just coming out?
It's just coming out.
So fecal incontinence can be a symptom sometimes of more severe neurologic issues or colon issues. It's probably worth consulting with your primary care veterinarian to do a more thorough neurologic exam and kind of suss out if there's something more serious happening back there. It seems like at 6 years old and with him not even knowing about it, it might be a little bit more than a behavior change.
Okay, Margaret, make an appointment with your vet. Thank you very much for calling. Sue in Madison, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. I have a question about raising different breeds of dog together. Now, I have a little bit of background with dogs. I was a vet tech, and I had my own pet sitting business. So I've worked with a lot of different breeds of dogs. I grew up with an Airedale, who we love more than anything. But my question is this. We're considering kind of moving to the country and like starting a little bit of a farm type thing, or at least a lot of gardening and maybe chickens. And I've read a lot about these herd dogs, like there's like a Turkish one and there's the Pyrenees. My question is, if we want to get, we haven't had dogs for a while because we're apartment livers. If we want to get like an Airedale, maybe like a lab type dog, or a German Shepherd, something like that, but also one of these like bigger herd dogs for the chickens and maybe just like a perimeter watcher, if you know what I mean. Is it better to get them all as puppies and raise them together, or is it better to, like, get the mild-mannered one? Like, I think the Pyrenees are supposed to be pretty good with other animals. What do you advise? I know that's a big question, but I read the different breeding things, and, like, I really want an Airedale or an Airedale mix, and I know they can be a little, well, I know they're mouthy, for one thing, but they're a little touchy, maybe, with other breeds, so that's my question. Like, do you have any advice on that?
Yeah, that is a big question. I think all breeds have, you know, the nature versus nurture thing. So even if you're getting a breed that is said to be a little bit more protective or might have some more behavior concerns to watch out for, if you're getting them young, that nurture does play a big role into it. So socializing them appropriately, introducing them to other dogs. We have to remember that a dog's personality is not just its breed. It's a lot of what we train into them. And so I wouldn't stop yourself from getting a breed that you like just because you know that you might need to pay attention a little bit more to its personality traits and train, do that training and commit to that training. It sounds like you're going to have a lot of space to do it and a lot of time to socialize that dog with the other dogs that you might have or being intending to get. And so, I hope that is a little bit helpful. I try not to again, reduce them just to what the book says about their breed.
Yeah. All right. Sue, there you go. Thank you so much. And Bruce in Houston, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Bruce.
Yes, I have a question. Do they have what they call a MASH unit for the veterinarians and especially for the understudy students? I understand that like down in the southern states, when they get hurricanes and tornadoes in, and the local vets get overwhelmed with helping, that they have kind of a MASH unit. Now, the reason I'm asking that, it seems like it, up here in the northern states, and once we get into July and August and September and the people start coming in our area, and they run into a porcupine and stuff, and they're having a problem of getting into a local vet.
So mobile vets, units. Are there mobile vet units that you know about here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, there certainly are mobile veterinarians. Mobile vets are a little bit more limited in what they might be able to do on scene. They might carry fewer drugs or monitoring equipment because they're taking everything with them. But it might be a good place to start if you have somebody local who can come to you, assess what's going on, and then make recommendations about driving to the nearest urgent care or emergency facility. Certainly something like porcupine quills, it can take hours to remove all of those quills, depending on how excited the dog got to meet that porcupine. And so generally that would be something that a veterinarian could maybe give some pain meds if they came to your house and then send you to the appropriate facility for the sedation and quill removal.
Sounds like you may have had experience with that.
Yeah, certainly.
Well, Dr. Sam Bilko, I want to thank you so much for being with us today. I hope you'll come back and be with us again. It was great having you.
I would love to. Thank you so much for having me.
Dr. Sam Bilko, UW School of Veterinary Medicine faculty member and small animal emergency and critical care veterinarian at UW Veterinary Care. Great to have her with us. And coming up next, we'll talk about electric toy trains with Roger Karp. He's senior editor of Classic Toy Trains magazine and the author of the new book, Lights, Camera, Lionel Trains, a photo history of an American icon. That next. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Well, the train sound. For several decades, starting before the Second World War, American children and adults have loved electric model trains. Train sets were the kind of ultimate Christmas gift and a major source of entertainment for countless families. I got a train set when I was, I think, about 8 years old, a Lionel train set. And we're going to be talking about Lionel trains, as a matter of fact, with our guest, Roger Karp. Roger is senior editor of Classic Toy Trains magazine and author of the new book. I have it right in front of me. It's titled Lights, Camera, Lionel Trains, A Photo History of an American Icon. As a kid, did you play with an electric toy train set, or are you an adult who still collects and works with model trains? I really hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Roger Karp with us by phone. Roger, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Larry, thank you so much for this invitation. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah, you've been a longtime editor of Classic Toy Trains magazine, certainly an expert on electric trains and their popularity. Why have they had such an enduring appeal for many Americans, you think?
It's a great question, and I think it really starts with the excitement of electricity. Electricity in the early 20th century was what AI and computers are today. It was a new frontier, and I think children were thrilled to be playing with something that was run by electricity. It was magical, and I think it's really had that magic ever since.
Yeah, I think you're right. You describe electric train sets as icons, American icons, like baseball caps or blue jeans or leather jackets. Everybody wants. How did that happen?
It was great advertising. It was great promotion by Lionel, which has been around for 125 years, which is remarkable for any business, but especially one that's in the toy field. And they marketed well. They marketed to adults, and they marketed to older children, and it was a status symbol to older kids to get this very sophisticated and expensive plaything, this electric appliance, if you will. But they advertised to parents and grandparents who were the ones buying toys. And they really gave the impression that the boy, and it was very much a segregated by gender toy market in, say, the first half of the 20th century, the boy who played with a Lionel train today would grow up to be a productive, industrious, civic-minded citizen, grow up to be the right kind of person that they wanted their young man to be. And so it just it was the perfect way to promote their trains.
It is really, really interesting how they were promoted. And your new book focuses on trains made by Lionel Company.
Yes.
Where did that name? I know where it came from, but I'll ask you, where did it come from, the name Lionel?
Well, it was the middle name of the principal founder of this company in 1900. His name was Joshua Lionel Cohen. And he realized that to go with calling it Joshua or calling it Cohen would call great attention to his ethnicity, to his Jewishness. And so he wisely opted for his middle name, Lionel, which I think we would agree sounds a bit aristocratic. It sounds very proper, maybe even with a hint of Anglicized in there. And interestingly, in 1910, 10 years later, he did Anglicize his last name, changing it to Cowan. And so, as he once said, Lionel was the obvious way to name his company.
And it's got a forward-sounding name to me, too. You know,
yeah.
Kind of a cool name for a product. So I like it a lot. And
yes.
Your book, which I'm really enjoying, is focused on on, in a way, on photography and how the Lionel trains and others were marketed, and I really enjoy the photos in the book. You've got
many
pages and little stories about each one, and we'll get into that, but I've got Kevin in La Crosse online and waiting to come on, so let's go there. Kevin, thank you for calling. Hi.
Thank you for having me. Hi.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for calling in.
So,
I just wanted to remark, I'm 36 years old now. My grandfather passed away when I was 3. I only really have one visual memory of him, but he left, I think it was a 2HO Lionel train set, model set, with my father, and told him to give it to me when I was 10. So my dad held on to it, and it was one of the coolest toys I ever got for Christmas, and honestly, the only one my grandpa really had time to give me, so I just wanted to leave that comment there.
Oh, that's cool. Do you get comments like sort of like that from other folks, Roger Carp?
I do, Kevin. Thank you so much. This notion that electric trains was a multi-generation hobby is something I've heard again and again, that when kids would be given a train set, especially in the 1940s and into the 50s, it was made clear to them that this was a family possession because it was expensive and it was sophisticated and everybody wanted to run it. It wasn't just for kids. So what Kevin just talked about, how a grandfather would pass it on to a father who would pass it on to Kevin, that's 3 generations. So you can tell this is much more than just a toy. This is more than a wagon or a pair of roller skates. This really has great sentimental value for a family. It's part of Kevin's family's heritage, and I imagine he'll hold on, and should the time come, he will pass it on to a next generation.
It's really cool, and people took really good care take really good care of those trains. That's much better, I think, than some of the other toy gifts that they might get.
So true, Larry. I can vividly remember at age 6 in 1957 when I received my first Lionel set. I had that sense, I have to take care of this. I can't damage it. I really have to take good care of this, including the boxes. And so I felt more grown up, as though my parents had entrusted me with something very valuable, very meaningful. And I would imagine countless children felt the same way.
Yeah, I certainly. And they were, I guess in a way, they were kind of expensive given the times, the early times in particular. You get back into the 30s, you had, a depression.
Oh, it's so true. I have done a little comparison of pricing and the consumer price index from the late 40s. And a Lionel train set, a middle-of-the-road set, was on par with a large radio console or even a small refrigerator as far as prices go, and which meant it could be, for the typical American worker, we're talking 2 weeks' pay. So no wonder families treasured these, and they considered it a family investment. In fact, Lionel said that. Their trains were a family investment in happiness. So no wonder they would be played with, put out for the holidays, and then so often put away in January. And the kids were told, it's put away. We'll take it out again around Thanksgiving. So it's just a whole different frame of mind. But yes, these were expensive, sophisticated, top-of-the-line playthings, toys.
Clint in Duluth, Minnesota, will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Clint.
Well, good afternoon. My 8-year-old brother and my 6-year-old self got our Lionel train in, I think, 1953 or 4. We still have it. I was we had loads of fun with it. Not only running the train, but it was, I'm sad to say we electrocuted a fair number of frogs on the track. And when we combined the track with the erector set and steel bearing, it made a great racetrack for things. So it was more than just train fun. And then when I was a medical resident in New Haven, Connecticut, and every day I walked to and, you know, past the Lionel dusty factory windows, and I would peer in and always it would trigger good memories.
Well, Clint, if I might make a little bit of a correction, but it's a good one. You mentioned New Haven, Connecticut. That's not where Lionel was. The factory that you saw was its great rival, the A.C. Gilbert Company, which did indeed make erector sets, but they also made a Lionel's rival competitor, American Flyer Trains. But the Gilbert Company was like Lionel. It was a brilliantly run enterprise, doing everything it could to reach and educate older boys. So thank you.
Clint, thanks a lot for calling. And Rick in Portage County?
Hi, Larry and guest. Thanks for taking my call. A number of years ago, we were staying on Mackinac Island, and after a big dinner, we were out for a stroll, and we ran into the caretaker of the Lionel Mansion on Mackinac Island, and he invited us into his quarters, and there was quite a display of trains in there. And there were some trains that, model trains that were extremely large, like I'd never seen. Maybe the cars were maybe 10 or 12 inches long. And it was just quite an amazing thing. He let us peer in the windows of the mansion, but it was quite an experience, and we were actually quite thrilled.
Oh, Rick, a great story. Roger, are you familiar with that mansion?
I am some, and I'm fascinated by Rick mentioning larger trains because it brings to mind the ones that were so popular in the 1940s and 50s. Before World War II, Lionel had a larger product line, and it was called Standard Gauge, and these were as post-war trains were die-cast metal and plastic. The ones before the war were pressed steel, and they were beautifully painted, beautiful enamels. And these are so valuable, and they just are gorgeous artifacts, gorgeous works of art that attest to the industrial excellence of Lionel. And so I think I know the mansion and what was there. So, Rick, thanks for mentioning that.
Rick, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate the call. Your book demonstrates how important photography was in advertising and marketing Lionel trains. And the company really embraced it, photography.
Yes, it did. From an early on, I'd say as early as the 1900s, and again, this is a company that started in 1900, very forward-thinking, very much marketing was important, and they wanted to show the trains because this was a way to sell them. And then as much as it could, Lionel would promote itself, because a still photograph is good, but moving pictures are even better. So starting in the 1920s, Lionel was working with Hollywood studios to get its trains placed in movies, especially in the 1930s and into the 1940s. This is a time of the year, maybe many of your listeners have watched the movie with Robert Mitchum and Janet Leigh called A Holiday, Holiday Affair. And that's a great one with Lionel trains in it. People Will Talk has Cary Grant and Gene Crane in it. And later in the 1950s, you would see Harry Belafonte with Lionel trains. And so it just photographs and movies were really, really important.
You got a really cool, you have so many cool photos in your book. I was remembering one with Olivia de Havilland and the movie,
yes.
And in the movie Four is a Crowd.
1938, Olivia de Havilland, Errol Flynn is in it, Rosalind Russell, great movie stars from that golden age of Hollywood. And an enormous Lionel display was built for this movie because it was used with one of the Hollywood themes. How do we show an old man that we think is all stuffy and serious and not in touch with younger generations? Let's have him pose with toy trains, and all of a sudden he comes alive, and that's what happens in this movie, and we've seen it in other movies. And so it was really something that Lionel was promoting in real life for dads that were worried about losing touch with their sons and daughters. An electric train, a Lionel train, would help dad stay youthful, not childish. He would stay boyish. He would have all those great qualities while he played with his kids. And in fact, as so many of your listeners can attest, that's what was happening in real life. Dads were working with their children together on a Lionel set. That was certainly my experience with my father. It was something that brought us together.
Yeah, mine as well. Elizabeth in Appleton, your turn. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Larry. This is a great show. I believe it was 1959, I won a Lionel electric train. I was about 4 years old, and my father was in the hospital, and my mother had four little girls at home. Then she entered a Cocoa Puffs contest, and the test was you took the letters of your name and had to scramble them up and make a new name. And, you know, she didn't think anything would come of this. But months went by, and packages started arriving to me. And my father was in the hospital. My mother was so worried about money and everything. And I saw the boxes, and I immediately knew it was the Lionel train. And I still have the original boxes. It still runs. And anyway, I just thought we only got it out at Christmas, and my mother made sure that we took care of it. 1 year after my father died, we got the train out, and I put a battery in the engine so that the horn would honk. And when we put the train away, we didn't take the battery out. So it rusted, but the only thing that's wrong with that train is that a little bit of rust on the engine, the horn doesn't work anymore. But we had years and years of fun with that.
Oh, that's,
and I hope to pass it on to grandchildren someday.
Great story, Elizabeth.
Oh, Elizabeth, thank you. And I would like to add, and I'm quite serious, I'd love to write a story for our magazine about what happened with you in that Cocoa Puffs contest. I don't know whether, Larry, if you can get contact information, but I'm quite serious. I have written about winners of contests before, but Elizabeth, your story is wonderful. It's heartwarming. And so, Larry, I hope I'm not breaking any rules.
No,
I think to follow up with Elizabeth and learn more and write a story.
The probably the simplest way would be for Elizabeth, maybe do you have a contact on your website?
I do. Yes. And, you can go to, I can give you my email.
Okay.
But which is, and really any of your listeners that want to share stories about their toy trains, I love hearing them. And my email is my first name, Roger, R-O-G-E-R, _ my last name, Carp, like the fish, C-A-R-P, @att.net. But we've got some great stories. But Elizabeth, yours is definitely an article in the magazine. So I'd love to work with you on that.
So Roger, and then the _.
Yes.
Carp, C-A-R-P, @att.net.
Yes.
I hope she follows up on that, and others want to join in. They can do it as well.
Absolutely.
There were insider and outsider shots that you cover in your book. What was the difference there?
It's sort of a broad and general distinction. Insider shots are photos that Lionel either commissioned or were taken within, say, one of Lionel's showrooms by visiting families, or maybe at its factory in New Jersey by journalists. I thought of outsider shots as ones that were taken, say, a family at Christmas, and just taking a picture for the family album of kids unwrapping their trains. Maybe they had gone to a department store and they snapped a picture of a display there. So they're quote-unquote amateurs, but the pictures are capturing beautiful moments. And so I try to blend them. Another example would be any of the publicity shots that Hollywood studios took of celebrities with toy trains. Betty Grable, Rita Hayworth.
Frank Sinatra was a fan.
Yes, he was. Frank Sinatra was a fan. Nat King Cole. And then more recently, your listeners are probably familiar with Neil Young, the great rock singer. Neil is passionate about Lionel trains. Mandy Patinkin, Broadway singing and movie star. So the interest continues.
Tim in Monona has a quick question, I believe. Tim, hi.
Hi, Larry. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call. Go ahead.
Yeah, just a question for your guest and a story to follow. I hope he could comment on the other gauges of toy trains, the HO scale and N scale and such, and how they competed with or were meant to compete with Lionel. And aside from that, just a quick story. My dad bought me a train set when I was just a tiny tot. And, of course, we were in bed, and my dad and my uncle decided that they needed to test it out to make sure that it worked.
You can imagine what happened from that. Tim, thanks for that story. Appreciate it very, very much. Well, there are these days there are a lot of model train shows. There's a resurgence in popularity, and now you can run them off an app and off your phone.
That is so true. In fact, my 6-year-old grandson uses an app on my phone to run a train using Bluetooth. And it's great. And this is how new generations are getting involved and enjoying toy trains, because technology has always been one of the drawing cards, whether it was electricity 100-plus years ago, and now we know that it's phones and it's Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. So that's really, to me, that's the excitement, that's the innovation, and that's what's going to keep this hobby going and continuing to interest people of different generations.
And I will mention, from December 6th through the 31st of December, Holiday Express Model Train and Flower Show at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. I never miss that. And I've really enjoyed your book, Roger. Thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. Roger Karp's book is Lights, Camera, Lionel Trains, A Photo History of an American Icon. And I'll give you his email again. It's roger_karp, C-A-R-P, at att.net. If you want to send him a story about your own Lionel trains. We didn't cover very much as we could have, but we covered a lot. I want to thank you for being with us, Roger. And big thanks, of course, to our normal crew, Joel Padnock, Clara Neipert, Lee Rayburn, and I am Larry Mehler.